Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Andrew Solomon about his remarkable new book, Far From the Tree.
I think that though this book describes extreme circumstances, that those extreme circumstances are illuminating about all of parenting.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. The Times' John Schwartz tells us what it's like to record your own audiobook.
I was going to have to do what the reader that I saw and what other people who had done this suggested that I do, which is to treat it like a conversation, that I'm in front of a microphone, but imagine myself talking to a friend.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Andrew Solomon is one of America's most admired and decorated nonfiction writers, a master of the narrative form. He has a major new book. It's called Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. It's reviewed on our cover by Julie Meyerson, who says Far From the Tree is generous, humane, compassionate, and a wise and beautiful book. I'm delighted that Andrew Solomon's here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
All right, Andrew, the first thing we have to say is we're talking about 962 pages. When did you get the idea for this book, and how long did you spend writing it?
I got the idea in about 2000, and I sold the idea in 2001. So I spent 11 years working on it.
And what kind of work are we talking about? This is really a picture of the very complicated relationships and surprises parents find when their children turn out to be a little different from what they hoped for.
Exactly. So I had years ago for the New York Times written a piece about the deaf, and I was very interested in deaf culture and in the idea that deafness existed as a culture. I hadn't known that before I set out to write about it, and I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents and that they therefore have to discover a cultural context among their peer group. And I thought it was very similar to the experience of gay people. Similar also because those hearing parents generally think their kids would really be happier if they were good at lip reading and oral speech. In the same way that a lot of parents think that it would be better if their kids could grow up and marry a girl if they're a boy, or marry a boy if they're a girl, and have a family in a conventional way. And so I suddenly saw these parallels. And then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And suddenly I saw the whole thing happening again.
So when you say the parents think their children would be happier, they kind of project a kind of disappointment or sorrow on the children that the children don't necessarily feel?
I think they project disappointment and sorrow that the children frequently do feel. And then I think many of those families actually cease to feel disappointed and sorrowful. But it's a transition. Before I wrote the book, I had conflated love and acceptance, and I kept thinking there were deficits in all kinds of love. There were perhaps deficits in my own parents' love. And I came to think those aren't really deficits in love. Most of the parents I've written about in the book love their children across the lifespan, but it's hard for them to accept them. And there's a sort of transition that they have to go through to achieve acceptance.
And in a way, Andrew, what you're describing is really a huge metaphor for all relations between parents and children. So what are some of the first of all, some of the people you met, where did you find them and how did you get them to tell you their stories?
So first, I want to say that you've hit the nail on the head. I think that though this book describes extreme circumstances, that those extreme circumstances are illuminating about all of parenting. So that's central.
And so you write about many families, many children, many parents. How do you research or report a book like this?
So the different chapters require different research approaches. Autism, you have only to sit down at dinner with anybody anywhere in America to have people immediately saying, you're writing about autism, you should talk to my sister. Let me introduce you to my cousin. For some of the subjects like Down syndrome, for example, I went to the National Down Syndrome Society. When I wanted to write about dwarfism, I went to the Little People of America convention and met a lot of people there, and then kept my ear to the ground for other people so it wouldn't all be people from the same source. Schizophrenia, I got in touch with doctors who treat schizophrenia and asked them to ask patients whether they'd be willing to talk to me. And for the chapter on families of kids who commit crimes, I actually took a job working in a juvenile correctional facility in Minnesota, working there as an advisor to a theater project rather than as a guard, but as a means of really getting to know some of the kids and thereby getting to know some of their families.
Now, when you approach them, do you say, I'm writing a book, I want to talk to you for it? Do you cultivate a relationship first? This is a question that comes up so often. What are the ethics of writing a book like this?
I think my starting position is that I try to go in with a feeling of respect and a willingness to hear people's story, which is very helpful to them. And I say to them from the very beginning, I will in the end have to make some judgments about your story, but I'm very happy to hear it, and I'm very happy to try to be true to it as I tell it. In interviewing families, which is what I was doing, you get conflicting stories. The mother tells you one thing, the father tells you another thing, the kid tells you another thing, his brother and sister tell you something else yet again. So it's tricky balancing all of those narratives and figuring out how to piece them together like a jigsaw puzzle. And there is, of course, a dance of seduction in which you're getting to know people and trying to convince them that you are the person to whom they can tell their story. And I don't think it's unethical, because I think I really am open to hearing those stories, but it's definitely a sense of my drawing something out of them. And what I found in writing this book, in which I asked many people to talk about very difficult experiences, was that most of the people who agreed to be in it said to me, I have felt very alone in the situation I've been in, and if telling my story to you will allow you to write a book that will make other people feel less alone and will spare other people from the pain and isolation I experienced, then I'm happy to do it no matter how hard it is.
Now, have any of your subjects, the people you interviewed, got to know, wrote about, have they've been reading the book yet? Are you hearing from any of them?
They have been reading the book, and I've heard from a lot of them. Most of them have been very happy. There was one person who was unhappy with the portrait of himself, and we had a long conversation about what it was that was troubling him, and I think it's all now resolved. A lot of people said, it isn't that I liked or disliked it, I just think you got me. The mother of one of the kids with Down syndrome, Emily Pearl Kingsley, who I wrote about but who's been written about many times before because she's been a big activist, said, no one previously quite got the story and you seem to have gotten it. And that's actually, to me, higher praise than people saying, I love the way you made me sound.
Were there people who wouldn't talk to you? Were there many rejections?
There are always many rejections in pursuing a book like this. There were a lot of people who didn't want to talk to me and then a year later got in touch and said, you know what, I've thought about it and actually now I do. But there were other people who just had too high a wall of privacy. I gave everyone in the book the option of being in by pseudonym. I would say about maybe 40% of the people in the book chose to do that. The other 60% spoke directly. A lot of the ones who wanted to be in by pseudonyms wanted to be in by pseudonyms not because they were embarrassed by their own story, but because they felt that they had children who were vulnerable and they didn't want to expose details about those children when the children weren't old enough to understand the meaning of that.
Now, here's a huge generalizing question. Did you find with all the parents you spoke to, did you get the sense generally that they really did the very best they could to understand and accept and to make the adjustments they needed to do? In some ways, they have to transform themselves.
So I should begin by saying that a book like this has got certain built-in research bias. Parents who actually hate their children and have a terrible relationship with them are less interested in telling their story, and they're harder to find. I felt as though almost all of the parents in the book were essentially loving people. I felt that some of them had been given more than they could handle and were overwhelmed by it, but I felt that many of them were given what initially seemed like more than they could handle and gradually figured out a way to handle it or respond to it. That's not to say it was easy, but they found a way through in the long term.
And do they or have they themselves grown and profited in some way? Are there those who would say, we would not want our child to be any different, that there was a kind of moral benefit for us as parents and people?
Oh, absolutely. I think of Tom and Karen Robards, who are quoted at the end of the Down syndrome chapter. And they have a son who was 23 years old at the time that I interviewed them. And they had got very involved in trying to change the way that educational services are delivered to people with DS. And started a tiny little center that ended up having quite an important influence and helping people to function much better who have the condition. And I said, well, it's been so central to your life. Do you regret it? Do you wish that you hadn't gone down that path? And his mother said, for our son, I regret it because it's a difficult way to be in the world. And if I could cure him, I would do it in an instant to make his life better and easier. But speaking for myself, we've grown and changed so much for this, and we've become better people as a result of it. And though I would never have believed 23 years ago that I could get to such a moment, speaking for myself, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
That's Andrew Solomon, whose new book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Welcome, Leslie.
Thanks.
Also, this is our first time in the air together. So
I know. It's a very exciting moment for me.
Great to have you on the program. Okay, so this is the season of these giant publishing mergers and takeovers, a lot of it in reaction to Amazon's increasing footprints. Are we hearing about any new possibilities there?
Right. So the big rumor this week was that Rupert, who we know, Murdoch, of course, of News Corp, is looking to acquire after the, you know, after Random House and Penguin merged, he let it be known he was willing to be a spoiler right before that deal was announced. So now it's clear he would like his imprint is HarperCollins, and it's clear he's out shopping again. We hear he'll be meeting with the folks from Simon & Schuster. So the big six could, in very short order, be the big four.
Now, Leslie, the Random House Penguin deal, that's done. That's definitely happening, right?
Well, you say it's done. It's definitely happening. It has to go through regulators. So it won't be done until 2013. But right, it doesn't look like anyone else is getting in on that. The papers are signed. If the European regulators say go, of course, both European companies, then we're good.
Okay, so now walk us through this. So you have Rupert Murdoch, the mogul of all media moguls, and whose empire includes one of the major publishing houses.
Right.
Now, he's got lots and lots of money, so he's probably not worried about that. What is it he's trying to do? Why would he want to acquire this other major publisher, Simon & Schuster? What's the potential advantage for him?
Well, so what everyone's looking at right now, so there are two big advantages. One, you could cut costs. You could merge together. You're going to cut costs, and you're going to bring everything together. Publishing's not a growing business, so if you're looking to keep the margins up, you want to always consolidate.
Well, when you say margins, you mean the actual profit margins
right. The
company makes.
Right, right. But here's the real reason we think everyone's getting down and dirty and finally merging is we think it's the Amazon effect. You need to have leverage to negotiate back. Amazon right now controls a lot of this market. People are scared to deal with them. They've tried to deal with them. So they think if they layer up and get some power, they'll be able to negotiate better deals. And Amazon's tough. So having leverage is a good thing.
So the way things work now, Amazon, because it is the giant of book retailers,
right. Can
call the shots about how much the publisher can charge for a book, what kind of discounts Amazon will give that might end up hurting the publisher in some way. All of this is really dominated by Amazon. So
Absolutely. The
publishers want to be able to do what in response?
They want to be able to set their own terms. I mean, right now, I hear that Amazon does this every year. At the end of the year, they call the publishers into Seattle, and they ask them to take a cut on how much they're going to get on each of their books. And they're monopolists in a certain way. They control so much of the market that they sort of say, you know, we really think it would be a good idea if you cut how much you charged us by 10% more this year. And so it's very scary for publishers who also fear that Amazon wants to actually get into the publishing business itself.
Which they have done to some extent,
right.
Although not with huge success so far.
Not
right?
with huge success so far, but, you know, it takes every – Rome wasn't built in a day. So, and if they knock other people out of the business, it may be that someday they'll be more successful. So what you want is to be able to come into Amazon and say, well, we are not going to take it on your terms. You're going to take it because you want our books, and we're so big that you can't do without us, that you're going to take it on our terms.
So Murdoch or someone in News Corp can meet with Amazon and say, well, here's your problem is if we don't like your terms, it's not just that you can't have HarperCollins books. Maybe you can't have Simon & Schuster books either.
Right. That's right. And so when you look out at the book market, right, it's divided into 50%. 50% of trade books are controlled by six right now, soon to be five publishers. And these are really the people that do the big book deals. You know, when you get name authors, they're all coming out of the only people who can afford them usually are these big six. And so these are the books that Amazon has to have, wants to have. And so they want to have more of that in one place to leverage up.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thanks.
This is John Williams, the books producer at The Times, and I'm here with John Schwartz, national correspondent at The Times, who has an essay in this week's book review about audiobooks, the recording of them, people's experience of being in the studio, and his own. Hi, John.
Hey.
You're a big audiobook reader. Where do you read the most, or where do you listen to the most, I should say?
If the audiobook is compelling, I listen to it everywhere. I've got the earbuds in, on my commute, in my morning run, when I'm doing dishes, and stealing snatches and moments. If it's a less compelling but interesting work, I make sure to get at least 45 minutes in on the morning run, and then I'm sort of pushing through whatever book
I'm in. That's the foundation, right? Okay. And so did you, and through listening to these, I assume you had a natural curiosity about the behind the scenes making of them, or
absolutely. The more you hear, you hear people acting, overacting, underacting. You just want to know what's going through their heads. Sometimes I'll be listening to someone narrating a really long book, and I swear that I hear just a touch of despair about three quarters of the way through. Will this ever be done?
Like a marathon runner on the 19th mile.
Exactly it. And so I just wanted to know more about how it's done.
And so you went into the actual studio. You went into a recording booth?
I went into the recording studio. I heard the recording of a Benjamin Black novel. Benjamin Black is the pen name of John Banville, mm-hmm. Who's a literary author, but he likes to play with crime novels as Benjamin Black, and they're all great. I heard an actor deliver this prose and watched him do it, watched his attitude, watched the director, producer advise him. Mm-hmm. And as with all acting, there's a reluctance to dictate a line reading. I'm not going to give you a line reading, but could this be a little more inward?
Right. And you try to get them to your line reading subtly.
Exactly. A little bit more pause here. But it was a collaboration. They'd worked together very well over a long period of time. And it was like any factory tour. It was a lot of fun.
And did it give you a new respect for the arduousness of doing this?
Absolutely. The amount of time that it takes, the amount of concentration, dedication, it's hard. It's hard not in the way that moving crates is hard, but it's still hard.
It's still a physical chore,
right?
On some level. I was at the Audie Awards earlier this year, the sort of industry. They were giving out the awards, and one of the actors there said to me that, even for a professionally trained actor, it can take, only 3 or 4 hours, and then after that they have to take a break because it just gets too taxing. Which brings me to the fact that part of the reason you wrote this essay is because you yourself, you just published your own book called Oddly Normal, One Family's Struggle to Help Their Teenage Son Come to Terms with His Sexuality. And you were going to go in and record your own version of the audiobook. And I suppose you wanted to learn some tips. What did you take with you into the studio that helped?
Well, first of all, I recognized that I have to be ready to deliver with energy, but not to overdo it. I was going to have to do what the reader that I saw and what other people who had done this suggested that I do, which is to treat it like a conversation, that I'm in front of a microphone, but imagine myself talking to a friend, and not to overdo it. And then listen to the director as well. I had a terrific director, Lisa Kahn, and she knew that I didn't know anything. She told me that there are professional actors doing this, and then there's the author read. And so I was an author read, and people might want to listen to it because, as a memoir especially, people might want to hear me deliver it. If I did it well enough, people would forgive what I didn't know.
Yeah, you get the personal angle, so it makes up for it. And then there are the author reads that are also happen to be professional actors like Tina Fey, who you spoke to for the piece.
Right. I did speak with Tina Fey, and I listened to a lot of memoirs. I love memoirs. And her book, Bossy Pants, she delivers. It's funny. It's punchy. It's also very personal. And so I was fascinated to hear her deliver it and to hear her then to exchange emails with her in which she talked about the experience. Another recent memoir that's by a professional is John Lithgow's
right.
drama. Mm-hmm. And Simon Pegg did a hilarious memoir called Nerd Do Well. And the professionals come in with an edge, believe me. They know what
I'm
they're
sure.
doing.
Yeah.
And it makes those books a lot more fun to listen to.
And your son, Joe, who's obviously a big part of your book, he wrote a part of your book and then he recorded his own section?
That's right. I brought him into the studio after I was done with my narration, which took about 3 days. Joe has a children's book that he wrote that was a perfect encapsulation of what I was trying to say in the book,
right.
except he did it in 800 words and I took 60,000. When it came time to do the audiobook, first I was pleased that they let me record my part, and then I said, well, how about Joe? And they said, sure. And they're very open to this.
Yeah.
And brought Joe in, and he did a terrific job reading his book.
Does he act?
He is interested in theater. He's been on stage. He was terrific as Dennis's mother in Spamalot at French Woods Festival
really?
Of the Arts
yeah,
a couple of years ago. There's some lovely filth over here, Dennis.
So he's doing voices already, too. That's
oh, yeah,
great.
He's great.
And you said it took 3 days. Are these three full sort of work days, or how many hours per day were you
they
in
were,
the studio?
They were 6 to 7 hours a day, 6 to 8 hours a day. It was talking the whole time. The process, different companies do the process differently.
Mm-hmm.
In my process, I was asked to read along until I messed up. When I messed up, take a breath. And then they would play the sentence up to the best place to jump in, and I would jump back into the sentence and finish it and move on, which seemed completely unnatural and ridiculous at first and then became completely natural, and you realize that you're producing one document for them.
Yeah, so there's a good reason they do it. That does
right.
sound terribly unnatural, but I'm glad to hear it got easier.
Well, once you adapt to it, then you know, you even get a sense, okay, that's what they're going to come back to, and then you can hop back in. And it was just fascinating to be inside the process, but also you're talking a long time.
Yes.
Hours and hours. I mean, I talk a lot. I'm a reporter. I get on the phone with people, but this was astonishing.
And did it leave you with a taste for it? Do you want to do it again? Or are you just exhausted and you're glad it's in the rearview mirror?
I think I'm going to give that a while to percolate and think about. If I did another book, I'd be happy to record another audiobook. But at the end of each day, I was worn out.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this isn't moving boxes around, but there's still a toll of that. And it's a personal book. It's a memoir. And so you're reliving the emotions when you're going through it as well. So I was emptied out, too, by the end of the third day.
I think in the essay you say that you and Tina Fey agree that it would be difficult to listen to your own work. Have you listened to your recording of the book, or do you plan to?
I have no interest in hearing myself read my book about me and my family. I did listen to about 30 seconds of it when I downloaded it to make sure it had come across.
Right.
And then I said, you know, this is creepy. And Tina Fey said it sounded just completely self-absorbed to listen to a book that you wrote that is about yourself, that it was so many layers of self-reference that it seemed almost creepy.
Yeah, let the people jogging and driving listen to it.
And God love them for it. You know, I hope they enjoy it.
I hope so, too. Thanks, John.
You bet.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Sam.
What have you got?
New on the fiction list at number 15, a personal favorite of mine, Alice Munro, with her latest story collection, Dear Life. It's only the second book of hers ever to make the list. The previous one was Runaway, but this is her 14th novel in her career. She had a long and excellent career. New at number 10, William Paul Young has a new novel called Crossroads. You may remember him. He was the author of a self-published novel called The Shack, a Christian novel about a guy having a conversation with God, and it became just a huge bestseller. So he's now been picked up by a mainstream publisher, Hachette Book Group's Christian imprint, Faith Words.
Can I make a big confession here?
Sure.
When you get to be
it's only appropriate.
Yes. When you get to be a certain age, and unfortunately I've reached that age, you can only hold so much vital information in your head. And I'm afraid I don't remember the Shack or Shack or whatever it was.
There was a year there when the Shack was pretty much unavoidable. And so now he's back, and this is about a comatose businessman talking to Jesus. And then Ian McEwan is new at number four with his new novel, Sweet Tooth. It's a spy novel set during the 1970s and gets very much into Britain's writing culture at that time. It's gotten excellent reviews. It's more fun than some of his recent fiction has been. It's a very playful novel.
It's remarkable how deep and broad an audience McEwan has in the United States. I mean, he really is a writer that people wait to read.
It's yeah. He's a Booker Prize winner. Atonement really, I think, sealed his reputation here. And then, of course, the movie version of that expanded it hugely. And yeah, people wait for the new Ian McEwan. They also wait for the new James Patterson, but maybe not as long. He's new on the list at number two with his latest Alex Cross book, which is called Merry Christmas, Alex Cross. That is about his titled detective character confronting a hostage situation at Christmas time.
You have to hand it to him. He's ahead of the curve. What's it called? Black Friday, whatever the day is when all the sales go up after Thanksgiving. And he's right there.
Yeah. And at the top of the list, there's also a new book, also a bestseller regular. Vince Flynn has one of his new militaristic macho novels called The Last Man. Featuring his recurring counterterrorism operative, Mitch Rapp.
I think I saw him when I was away last week on MSNBC commenting on the Petraeus scandal.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I know Tom Clancy used to be brought in to comment on military matters. And I guess Vince Flynn is the next generation of that.
Right. He plays the expert on TV.
He looks the part, doesn't he?
He does.
He's a big guy.
Very charismatic, telegenic presence.
Yeah.
Okay, what about nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, there's a lot of churn. I think Christmas shopping has started early. Down at number 15, Oliver Stone and a Cold War scholar named Peter Kuznick have a book called The Untold History of the United States. This is a companion volume to a Showtime series, a 10-part Showtime series that Stone has developed. It's kind of a revisionist history of American foreign policy going back to before World War II, looking at America as a militaristic empire builder, sort of a foreign policy counterpart to Howard Zinn. The People's History of the United States.
Right, with kind of a, unsurprisingly, sort of leftward tilt.
Yeah, condemning America and its policies. That book has caught some heat, actually, for being fairly sympathetic to the Soviet Union under Stalin. And
the Hitler Pact and all of that.
Yes, exactly. Arguing that America kind of tied the Soviet hand and forced them into some of their unpalatable policies. At number 14, Willie Nelson, the 79-year-old Willie Nelson, has a new book, sort of a memoir, sort of a road journal, just filled with kind of musings and observations, called Roll Me Up and Smoke Me When I Die, which is the title of one of his songs as well. Then jumping up to number 10, Jake Tapper, the ABC News correspondent and former Salon writer, has a book called The Outpost about a Taliban attack on an American outpost in 2009. New at number 9 on the list, Andrew Solomon, his new book, Far From the Tree.
And a guest this week on our podcast.
Yeah, that book, it's huge. It's like 1,000 pages long, and it's fairly demanding of its readers. It's smart, very dense prose, but really fascinating. Yeah, and it's gotten some great reviews, including in the book review.
It's one of those books, as soon as you heard what the topic was, you knew it was destined for success because there's a kind of simplicity to it on the one hand, but there's something very broad and rich
about it. And, of
course,
it's a parenting book, and they've done very well lately. And it's a very serious, very substantial parenting book. Also serious and substantial, the Fox News host Greg Gutfeld has a book at number 7 called The Joy of Hate. I'm kidding. It's not serious or substantial. He has a real shtick going. He's kind of a Bill O'Reilly in training, and this book is a collection of rants, really picking on liberal hypocrisy, double standards, people who claim to be tolerant but can't tolerate alternative viewpoints from the conservatives.
Whereas he approaches alternative viewpoints with subtlety, nuance, and real philosophical curiosity.
He's fair and balanced. At number 5, the futurist Ray Kurzweil has a new book called How to Create a Mind. Do you know anything about Kurzweil?
Yes, I think I do, but you tell me more.
Well, he's an advocate for what he calls the singularity. He really thinks technology can not only solve a lot of human problems, but in fact that humans and technology will merge at some point, that we'll all be walking around with kind of implanted chips in our brains to help our memory, and kind of that we'll all be like the bionic man at some point. He has been a big advocate of technology and an innovator going way back. He is responsible for a lot of the sound of 1980s music because he started a synthesizer company that Duran Duran and Eddie Van Halen and Peter Gabriel, they all played his synthesizers back in the 80s. And he started that company as a challenge from Stevie Wonder. What he really did first was invented a machine reading to the blind, and Stevie Wonder used his machine and became friends with him and challenged him to make a synthesizer that sounded like a real piano.
Right, because Stevie Wonder was a big synthesizer guy back
then. That's exactly it. And he said it can't be – you know, Stevie Wonder said nobody can make a synthesizer that sounds like the real thing. And Kurzweil said, I can do it. And he did. He digitally sampled the sound of a piano and programmed it into a synthesizer. And lo and behold, you know, everyone used them. So his new book talks about how – advances in neuroscience help people trying to come up with artificial intelligence. Again, it's the crossover between humans and machines. And then finally, the top-ranking new book on the list this week is at number 2. It's John Meacham's biography of Thomas Jefferson called Thomas Jefferson.
The Art of Power. Isn't that the subtitle?
Our list does not give subtitles, but I'm not going to contradict you on that.
Well, it was reviewed for us, of course. Of course, by our boss, Jill Abramson.
On the cover.
On the cover.
Very substantial review.
Very substantial review and reviewed in the Daily Times this week.
That's right.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.